The climate is changing, and the U.S. military is on the front lines. Former military leaders, top brass, are increasingly sounding the alert that climate change is a direct national security threat to the United States. The clearest threat? Naval installations, other facilities on the water's edge, including the naval base at Norfolk, Virginia, the world's largest, at risk of being underwater as sea levels rise over the next 100 years. And that's just the beginning. Climate change is changing the planet, and that means it's changing the threats that we're going to ask the military to deal with. Can the military help us innovate our way out of this problem, or do we just need them to help sound the alert to politicians that climate change is a real threat? Retired Navy Admiral David Titley is an expert in the field of climate, the Arctic, and national security. He's professor in the Department of Meteorology and Atmospheric Science at Penn State. Admiral, welcome.
Hi, Todd.
Also with us to talk about an energy initiative that could be operational moving forward in the military, Sharon Burke. She's senior advisor for the International Security Program and Resource Security at New America in D.C. Sharon, welcome.
Good to be with you, Todd.
Admiral, what does it mean to frame climate change as a national security threat? Is this the only way that we can get the political system to pay real attention? And I ask it in this way because Colin Powell is famous for helping motivate President George W. Bush to enact a major push on international AIDS by framing AIDS as a national security threat.
It's not really for me to say whether this will or will not motivate the political dialogue. So I would really just stick to this as a military issue. And as a retired senior military officer, I think it's really incumbent to lay out in plain language some of the challenges and even threats to U.S. Security writ large that we have going forward. So the climate is what I would call actually a risk more than a threat. If I think of the threat, I think of like back in the with the Soviets in the 70s and the 80s, and you know they had their finger on the nuclear button, and you know we tried to understand not only their military capabilities but their intentions. The climate is a little different. It doesn't have intentions. It's just physics. The ice doesn't care who wins this next election. The ice doesn't care who controls Congress. The ice just melts. So it's really this risk. And with the ice increasingly melting, the seas are going to rise. Ultimately, they're going to rise several feet, many feet. And we are going to have to deal with this. So climate as a security risk really comes down to the number of jobs and the number of unstable security situations are likely to increase in already unstable parts of the world. And at the same time, the climate is going to put both financial and military and readiness pressure on our U.S. forces as we train them to be ready at home. So it's both a home threat and an away threat.
So Sharon Burke, Admiral Titley is talking about two levels of risk and threat directly to a naval installation like Norfolk, and there are dozens like it, where sea levels rise, you can't use the port anymore. It's expensive. You have to move it inland or retool it to deal with the problem. But then the larger threat overseas, where drought, flooding causes instability, we're going to ask the military to intervene in those places.
That is true. And I think it's not just coastal installations. We also have a lot of military bases that are in arid areas. So there are going to be adjustments that have to be made in many, many places. So we have to take that into consideration. But the big challenge here is what the Pentagon in its core strategy documents has called an instability accelerant, that climate change affects underlying problems. So if you have weak governance, if you have a history of conflict, if you have poor access to water, to energy, the things that actually build human security, then you're at risk for hard security, for an actual conflict situation. And climate change can come in as an instability accelerator and make those things blow apart into actual conflict. And that's where the Pentagon needs to anticipate where these new factors might create new problems.
So Todd, maybe some of your listeners remember the old BASF commercial, they don't make things, they make things better. I would say right. With climate and security, climate doesn't make the situation, but it makes bad situations worse.
And in ways that aren't all that predictable at this time, because these weather effects that you're going to see from a shifting climate aren't necessarily knowable, but particularly how they affect life on the ground. So those are the things that I think now the Pentagon needs to turn to and have a demand signal for the kind of information they need to be able to plan for the future.
But Sharon, we've heard time after time, and I cover Congress and I spend plenty of time there, where orders to the Pentagon written into legislation require the military to not deal on some levels with climate change, to not bake it into their policy plans, and to not spend money on it.
I think that's terribly unfortunate. It happens every year in the defense authorization debates that there'll be a member who will stand up and make those kinds of proclamations. This should not be a partisan issue, because when you get right down to it, in this country, in every district in this country, people are recognizing that things are changing. So this is a reality for Americans and people all over the world.
Admiral Titley, what's the most proximal risk or threat from your perspective, let's say at naval installations all around the Gulf Coast and the Atlantic Coast, for instance? Is it to build seawalls and protect those installations, or is it to find ways to move them inland as sea levels rise? If you were briefing a bunch of planners and a bunch of people who were going to spend the money on climate change over the next 50 years, what would you tell them?
The part that you really have to do first is as you look at these issues, is you find that they don't scale particularly well. That's kind of a strange way of saying every place, it's kind of like the old Tip O'Neill thing, every place is local and every place is a little different. They're different culturally, but they're also different physically. So like a levee may make a lot of sense in some places, but if you build like a really big levee in South Florida, turns out you're building it on limestone. So the water kind of laughs at you and just goes under the levee. So you need to understand the local conditions writ large, and that means, as I said, culturally, you need to understand the community. It's really important to think much broader than the base. Many people understand that while we have these marvelous bases like Norfolk Naval Base, but the people live in the community. The services like power, sewer, water, all come from and go back into the community. So, you know, you could build, let's say, a 9-foot wall, you know, at great cost, but you could build a 9-foot wall around the Norfolk Naval Base and keep it dry, and that's great. But if you don't have a workforce, either military or civilian, it hasn't really done you a whole lot of good. And in the military, yes, we look at most likely threats, but we also look at the most dangerous threats. So we could hope that in 50 years we're only talking about, let's say, a half foot to a foot, maybe a little more of sea level rise. But there are some credible studies that, especially for Norfolk, where you have a lot of things coming into play in addition to the global sea level rise, you probably, as a worst case, would be looking at like almost 3 feet. And then it's not only the average every day you wake up, it's a nice sunny day and the sea's 3 feet higher, but you got to think about then when a hurricane, even when a big nor'easter storm comes through, what does that mean? Some of that analytical work has actually already been done. The Army Corps of Engineers have done some nice studies on this, but now it's the hard part. Now it's the time where you have to start making those tough decisions. My expectation is it will be a combination of what we would call soft infrastructure, let's say natural protections, marshes that kind of dampen some of the storm surge. There will no doubt be some hard infrastructure, seawalls, levees, things like that. But at some point, there may be places that we just simply cannot afford to keep anymore, and you start having to relocate. Those are very, very hard decisions.
Well, Sharon Burke, this talk of building seawalls means that there are some huge walls that the next president may in fact have to build. And I can't get around the idea that one of the presidential candidates has said that climate change is a hoax invented by the Chinese to destroy our economy. Now, as we're talking about this problem, and we have the potential for a president who sees it almost 180 degrees opposite, what does that say to you about the work that needs to be done here?
I mean, obviously it makes the work more challenging, but at the same time, one of the things that we have seen, because the federal politics are complicated and not very conducive to progress, is that at the state and local level, there's been a lot of progress in dealing with climate change in all aspects. I was just down in Orlando, Florida, talking to some local officials there. And so, for example, they're doing a lot to cut their greenhouse gas emissions to do that, but also because it's good for their town. It makes their town more livable, makes their town more sustainable. They're also looking at adaptation, and they don't really have a choice because they're having a lot more inland flooding problems. when you get to the local level, the politics become secondary to the fact that if the street's flooding, you have to do something about it. So if we do get a president, heaven forbid, who says things like that, what will happen is it'll really shift the need for action to the local and state level even more than it already has been. And also it'll really put the onus on the private sector to move ahead. And again, when you're actually having to deal with these realities, you don't have the luxury of saying it's a hoax. So the insurance industry in Florida is not going to wait to be told by a member of Congress or by a recalcitrant president that they have to adjust to the fact that their investments are at risk in South Florida and other parts of that state.
That's Sharon Burke. She's the senior advisor for the International Security Program and Resource Security at New America. She's also former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Operational Energy under the Obama administration. Sharon Burke, thank you.
My pleasure.
Also, thanks, retired Navy Admiral David Titley.
Thanks, Todd.